Thank you. Open public input. We do have a number of people who've signed up. So if you would please come forward when I call your name. John Rosapipi, you've testified before us previously. Welcome back. And you, I think everyone who signed up knows the rules. We provide the public with individuals who want to testify with 3 minutes. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up and we'd like you to conclude. So, Mr. Rosapipi.
Good morning, Chair, and the rest of the Life in the state of Washington and nationally. You should have received our letter we sent this Monday to Governor Inslee expressing our concerns about wolf management in the state. One of the things we're particularly concerned.
Could you speak, bring the mic closer? Yeah.
One of the items we're concerned about is the recent protocol for lethal take of depredating wolves. As you all know, wolves are in the infancy of recovering. Last year, there were a minimum of 51. There probably won't be a big increase this year. We probably won't see new packs in the North Cascades, none of the South Cascades. Any taking of wolves right now will harm recovery. Ranchers are compensated, both state and federally, for depredations, so that you have a situation where you could have recovering wolves and minimizing livestock with all the different non-lethal conflict measures that are out there. Unfortunately, the state has decided for the protocol to allow for 2 depredations over a calendar year period where they could start removing wolves. There's no science to this. And scientifically, if you don't have science to support it, you want to do the precautionary principle for managing a recovering population. So that we're looking at asking for 4 depredations over a 4-month period, and then you'd reset it if it hadn't been reached. These are situations where people already have livestock conflict non-lethal measures in place. We're looking at Oregon, where they have 4 depredations over a 6-month period. And they have 7 wolf packs. Under the Washington standard, 3 of them would have been members, or the whole pack would have been taken out. But it shows that you can have a higher threshold, a longer time, have a situation where both ranchers, livestock, the public, and conservationists can live together. This is way too low. We hope it would be rescinded and that further talks that are going before the WAG will continue and a better solution can be met. So that's the thrust of the letter. Yeah, again, we feel that Oregon, both politically, demographically, geography-wise, is more of a model than Idaho or Montana. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Anderson, were you planning to give a wolf update? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, as always.
Rob Kavanaugh, would you please come forward?
Good morning, Commissioners. I hope you enjoyed that beautiful sunrise this morning. It's unusual that we see the sun in the morning here. I'm here to talk to you about protecting eelgrass species. It is protected under the Shorelines Management Act, under the Federal Clean Water Act, but recently we've run into an obstacle. Where I'm coming from is right here. I wrote this bill in cooperation with the Ducks Unlimited chapters of this state, the National Audubon chapters of this state, and Washington Waterfowl. So far, we've raised about $11 million to protect wetlands habitat and manage waterfowl. But much of that will be undone if the growers in Willapa Bay and elsewhere are allowed to spray and eradicate Zostera japonica. That's one of the two species that's found here in the state. And so what I'm presenting to you today, and I gave you a handout showing you a picture of Japanese eelgrass. And by the way, there's 120,000 ducks in Willapa Bay last year that were feeding primarily on Japanese eelgrass. 41% of the food intake for black brant up in Padillo Bay was Japanese eelgrass. So it's extremely important to waterfowl. It's also a rearing and breeding ground for invertebrates like crabs, and also a rearing area for juvenile chum salmon. The smolting chum salmon live in those eelgrass beds when the tide changes. One of the issues is that there is an intermingling of Zostera japonica with Zostera marina in some areas. Normally, japonica will be found in the higher intertidal area, marina in the lower subtidal areas. But in Willapa Bay, we find it co-mingling. So if we allow the spraying of japonica and it is adjacent to marina, it will kill marina. They're going to spray it with amazimox. They have no buffers separating the two in their proposals, in their draft EIS, okay? It will kill beneficial species, and that's what we're trying to stop, because we're in the business of protecting wildlife habitat, not destroying it. And what happened here was that in 2011, the Taylor Shellfish Company wrote a letter written by Bill Drury for the director to sign. And we have a copy of Bill Drury's letter. And it basically went to Representative Brian Blake, which paved the way for the Weed Board to list Zostera japonica as a noxious weed. If he hadn't done that, they could not have done it. But he did it. And we know why he did it, and we have all the documentation why. It was from pressure from Brian Blake to infringe on the department's budget if he didn't cooperate with them. And I interviewed the assistant director who was there, Lisa Vernaroso, so I know that's a fact.
Okay, thank you. The beeper was going off, so...
Yeah, I stopped.
Yeah, okay, good. Commissioner Smitten?
Thank you, Chair. Yesterday, Mr. Kavanaugh and I got into a discussion on Western gray squirrels, and I understand that he had was going to testify on that. He's used his 3 minutes. I wondered if we could allow him to summarize his view on that. I know we have only a handful of speakers. It's unusual, but I would ask if we could allow him to summarize those comments.
Sure.
Is that okay? Mm-hmm. We've petitioned you to list the Western gray squirrel as an endangered species. We've monitored the decline of the Western gray squirrel for the last 20 years. There are three populations. One is in Klickitat, one is in Fort Lewis, and one is up in Okanagan, Chelan. They are ever decreasing because their habitat is decreasing. The Forest Practices Act allows for the DNR to condition the forest practices, but Commissioner Goldmark has changed his policy. He no longer cooperates with Fish and Wildlife. There's no memorandum of agreement to do so. So now we don't have any protection from the DNR. So that's what's causing the decline of the Western gray squirrel. We've documented this. The Western gray squirrel has been studied extensively by our staff. Mary Linders, Matt Vanderhagen are the scientists. Yet when it gets over to the Forest Practices Board, Joe Storr, the deputy for this agency, says he's not going to do anything. And that will lead to their extinction sooner rather than later. And so we want you to put it on the endangered species list to give it more protection, more emphasis, more priority, so we can somehow protect it. And I gave you a report on that. And today is the day that I petitioned you under RCW 34.05 to list the Western gray squirrel as an endangered species.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Robert Dashiel.
Good My name is Robert Dashiell. I live on Bainbridge Island, and I represent just myself. A little background, I'm a beach naturalist. I'm an ex-submariner. I have been a 22-year volunteer for different environmental organizations. I work with the Department of Ecology on overflights of Puget Sound, and I'm qualified to do fish talks at the Seattle Aquarium, specifically on the Cedar River. But I want to talk a little bit about fish passage culverts, and I'm going to give you a perspective that you aren't necessarily in charge of as a commission, but it's a hot topic on Bainbridge Island, and that's where the governor's from, and so I'm just saying it's causing some municipal interest. The question is, who pays for fish passage culverts? Traditionally, we've put in four. The city has paid for all of them. They're using stormwater funds. Stormwater funds are authorized by the state legislature in 1986 to pay for MS4, municipal stormwater systems, and the second condition is to provide to mitigate the common enemy of flooding. So a city's responsible for a culvert, for putting in a flood control culvert. The problem is that a fish passage culvert is about 10 times as expensive as a flood control culvert. So the question is what happens to that delta? The city's responsible for paying for flood control to make sure that the water gets from the left-hand side of the road to the right-hand side of the road. But the city doesn't own the stream bed, the city doesn't own the water, the city doesn't own the fish, and the city municipal MS4 system is the flood control system is authorized only to put in the flood control. So the question is who pays for that other 80%? And that's just an issue. I don't have any answers, but it's a hot topic on Bainbridge Island. I can just say that there was one on contract, going under contract right now. We can put a flood control culvert in for $30,000. Estimated cost is about $200,000 and $250,000 to put a fish passage in. The other problem is the stream they're putting it in has no record of fish. Nobody's electroshocked the stream. I've written public records requests to Fish and Wildlife to see what are the written records of what's in here. It's a stream that has about 3 inches of water. No record by Fish and Wildlife at all of any fish in the stream. That's a problem. So the next thing is I ask, because I'm a photographer, and I sometimes do National Geographic work, and I photograph a lot of things. So I go and photograph some of the fish passages that have been put in and the cost. So I write to Fish and Wildlife and ask, under a public records request, what are the effectiveness of putting a fish passage culvert in? And the answer is, we haven't done any studies because we don't have the money to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. You pose a lot of good questions. All right, that concludes the open public input.
Miranda, I'll give you one more.
Oh, one more? Sorry. Story Warren, you're back. Come on up here. Good to see you again.
I would like to ask you to reconsider the new lethal control protocol for wolves. Recovery should be the primary objective for gray wolves in Washington at this point. That does not mean that livestock owners have to be thrown under the bus to do that. Non-lethal deterrents have been proven very effective across the country and the Pacific Northwest, including work done by the department and other organizations in Washington. At this stage of recovery, every individual and certainly every pack is important. Killing an individual or an entire pack after only two depredations isn't in anyone's best interest. Look at the wedge pack situation. The whole pack was killed, but it didn't solve the problem. More wolves soon returned to that area. It is much more effective to work with and teach the wolves that are already in an area than to keep having to deal with new ones. Two strikes is not enough for an out, and it doesn't benefit any party. Please reconsider. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that does conclude the open public input item, and we can move into the